I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry has embarked on a two-week tour of 21 states, starting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, following last night's acceptance speech closing the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Here are some excerpts.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty. I'm not kidding. I was born in the West Wing. And it's time for those who talk about family values to start valuing families. We are here to affirm that when Americans stand up and speak their minds and say America can do better, that is not a challenge to patriotism. It is the heart and soul of patriotism.
Democratic candidate John Kerry speaking last night. Meanwhile, President Bush is on a swing state tour of his own, which will take him to four battlegrounds, Missouri, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, over the next 2 days. He fired one of his first salvos this morning.
There'll be big differences in this campaign. They're going to raise your taxes. We're not. We have a clear vision on how to win the war on terror and bring peace to the world. They somehow believe the heart and soul of America can be found in Hollywood. The heart and soul of America is found right here in Springfield, Missouri.
President Bush speaking today. Well, how did candidate Kerry do last night? We're joined in the studio by political commentator David Nyhan. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Robin.
And joining us from the Kerry campaign press bus is Jake Schlesinger, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Jake, how is the Kerry campaign feeling about the speech?
They say they're feeling very upbeat. And, of course, you know, you'd expect them to say that, short of him falling off the stage. I think that, you know, most folks that I've talked to the extent you can find someone objective, I think thinks that he's not a Clinton, but he gave a good speech, certainly by his standards, and got done a lot of things he needed to get done.
Well, David Nyhan here in the studio, Tom Shales in the Washington Post called it a stunningly passionate acceptance speech. You've been listening to John Kerry for many decades now. What do you think?
Many decades. Okay, three decades. It was the best speech I've ever seen Kerry give. I've seen a couple of hundred of them. He was more animated. He had more arm movement. There were a lot of Kennedy riffs in that thumping, hortatory, shouting thing. He came up a little short on Iraq, as far as I'm concerned, but his delivery was the best I've ever seen. I think the crowd in the hall, at least, felt that he can win this thing, and I think he senses that too. And when candidates get that aura about them, they get bigger, they expand, they get more confident.
Let's listen to a portion where some might say he sounded just like that.
They say this is the best economy that we've ever had, and they say anyone who thinks otherwise is a pessimist. Well, here is our answer. There is nothing more pessimistic than saying that America can't do better.
Jake obviously attempts several times in the speech to paint the Democratic Party and the candidate as optimistic.
Right. I mean, there was no subtlety about that. They kept using the word optimistic, and we know we're the can-do people, so I think that message came through loud and clear.
Jake, how is the campaign responding to the Republican criticism that we heard right after the speech from people like Rudolph Giuliani, that he didn't tell people what he'd done post-Vietnam?
You know, that is an interesting question. It's not entirely true. I mean, I think it's by and large correct, but, you know, when he talks about working with John McCain to normalize relations with Vietnam, I mean, that is one of the hallmark accomplishments of his term in the Senate. But it is interesting that he hasn't talked that much about the things that he did in the Senate. But I think that the response in general is that wasn't really what the point of the speech was. I mean, the Vietnam thing wasn't to say this is my primary qualification to be president. It was more to establish him in a military mode in a way that nothing else really does as graphically. So it was there, but it was not that explicit.
Robin, the issue is the war. he's running on Vietnam instead of Iraq because there are no good answers for Iraq. And by cementing his credentials as a war hero and a guy, a patriot who put his life on the line, that is the way to reach the. It's a dignified lunge for those 10% of voters in the swing states who are undecided. To me, the most important event of the week was Kerry gave a good speech. The second most important thing was General Shalakashvili. His showing up, cashiered by Rumsfeld and Cheney for daring to say they didn't have enough boots on the ground in Iraq, and then to come out and endorse the ticket in that dignified, soldierly fashion, then to be joined by a dozen other admirals. If I were Kerry, I would make a commercial out of Shalakashvili and say the guy who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs says our guy is the guy, and the implication is Bush is not up to the job.
Well, it's funny, David, when I hear you say that you thought he didn't say enough about Iraq, you meant some of the pointed comments you wanted to hear, because some are saying, Jake, this is probably the most militaristic Democratic convention they've ever seen.
It certainly was. And what struck me, you know, reading the speech before they passed it out was, this did not read like a speech of a Democratic presidential candidate. And I think that's a function of the fact that he is fortunate to have such a unified base that he doesn't have to talk to them. They don't need to hear him say the standard Democratic thing.
Kerry has been deeply criticized for being wishy-washy on issues like the war in Iraq. He addressed that last night. Let's listen.
Now I know that there are those who criticize me for seeing complexities, and I do, because some issues just aren't all that simple. Saying there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq doesn't make it so. Saying we can fight a war on the cheap doesn't make it so. And proclaiming mission accomplished certainly doesn't make it so.
There were people saying afterwards, I was at the Fleet Center, and there were people saying that they felt that what John Kerry did last night was take back the issues of optimism, take back the flag, take back patriotism, wrest it back from the Republican Party.
Bush's father beat Dukakis, who left the 88 convention with a 17-point lead. Mm-hmm. They beat him by painting him as unpatriotic and weak and ineffectual. Kerry went to school on that. He's talked to Dukakis about that. The one reason you saw so much about Vietnam and veterans and the Swift boat and carrying your M16 is that they want to insulate them. The Democrats want to insulate Kerry from charges that he's a weak, ineffectual liberal. And the problem for Karl Rove is how do you knock a guy as a weak wimp when he's killed an enemy soldier in combat?
Well, I want to thank you both.
Good luck, Jake, on the road.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Let me know if I can send you a stale bagel or something.
David Nyan, political commentator. Jake Schlesinger, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, on the campaign bus with candidate John Kerry.
At a time when Capitol Hill is usually shut down for the summer, the Senate is open for business today. Members of the 9/11 Commission are testifying before the Senate's Governmental Affairs Committee. The committee is looking into some of the specific proposals for change suggested by the commission last week. Here's Senator Joe Lieberman, co-chair of the Governmental Committee, speaking at the hearings.
We cannot let another attack succeed because of our own inaction, and we meet to begin these deliberations at a time when our nation has been given fair and factual warning that our terrorist enemies intend to attack again. Your commission's recommendations offer us a chance to seize control of our future.
Gail Chaddock is covering the hearings for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us on the line from Washington. Hello, Gail.
Hello.
Now, Gail, the 9/11 committee chair, Thomas Kane, today said that all the commission's recommendations should be taken seriously, but he emphasized these.
They have to unify strategic intelligence and operational planning against Islamic terrorists across the foreign domestic divide with a national counterterrorism center. They must unify the intelligence community with a new national intelligence director.
We've actually heard some of these ideas over the last few years. Was there anything specific said, Gail, about how to implement these recommendations?
I think the main point everyone is making right now is speed. That is coming back in August already as a change. The House is looking to hold at least 15 hearings this month. The Senate is also galvanizing around this issue. It's unprecedented in an election year, especially one as close as this election, to focus on this topic, which is not directly related to who gets elected.
Well,
in August, it's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, but around, I mean, in the margins, I mean, is there any sense that, you know, we've got 90 days till there's a quite possibly a change of administration? Is it likely that you're going to have legislation written, reported on, voted on, and then enacted before the November presidential elections?
I think it's very likely. The Senate has set an October 1st deadline for legislation being prepared. The White House is certain to start implementing pieces of this by executive order as soon as possible. The challenge will be, and this is something that the chair and co-chair say every opportunity they get, this is a piece. All these pieces are related. You can't just implement, move the deck chairs around and make a few new boxes and expect anything to change in terms of the country being safer. So they are going to continue to press for a comprehensive approach.
In that comprehensive approach, there were many recommendations, of course, in the 9/11 report, in addition to the national national intelligence agency, which I think everybody understands. What other recommendations are likely to make it into the legislation?
I think the biggest one, and if you listen to what the Chairman Cain was saying, what they want is a quarterback, someone who actually has responsibility and also a budget capacity. This is something that hasn't existed before. You have a CIA director who is supposed to be coordinating the whole effort, but who really doesn't control what goes on in the Pentagon, certainly not budgets. They're trying to combine both those functions. That involves a ferocious turf battle. There's another interesting one that's shaping up in the Congress, where you have an intelligence committee that sets the tone for authorizing funds, but doesn't actually provide the money. There's going to be a fight between the intelligence committees and the appropriation committee on who actually decides where the money goes. That's going to be a bruising battle in Congress. Whether they are willing to engage it before November, I'm not sure.
Is there any possibility that those two committees might return early from summer holiday to do their job on getting this legislation passed ASAP?
They're already working on this. This is something, it's interesting. You find both Senators Rockefeller and Roberts, chairman of that committee, who have disagreed on lots of issues on this, standing shoulder to shoulder. This is a fight they're going to fight together.
Gail Chadwick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick is covering the 9/11 Commission hearings for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us from Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, veterans of the war weigh in on Bush versus Kerry.
And later in the show, who's the bad guy in the new Manchurian candidate now that the Cold War is over?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Much of the focus of this week's DNC was on John Kerry's service in the Navy during Vietnam, the message Kerry is better equipped to lead the country in this time of war. Some veterans from the battles in Iraq and Afghanistan have organized to support that idea. They call their group Operation Truth, and they were in Boston with their claim that some of the military rank and file are growing increasingly disaffected with the Bush administration. We met one veteran yesterday at the Fleet Center.
My name's David Chastain. I'm from Indiana originally. I was a captain in the Army until May, and I was a captain in the Chemical Corps.
And describe yourself.
I'm a registered Republican, and I'm a vet.
Been in Iraq?
That's right. I was in Iraq last year. I'm an evangelical Christian. I went to Olivet Nazarene University. My family has been Nazarene for about four generations back. And I voted for Bush in 2000, twice, in the primary and the general. And this year, I'm probably going to vote for Kerry unless something drastic changes between now and the fall in terms of the foreign policy and military policy of the current administration.
Because?
Well, I was very unhappy. I'm a chemical weapons officer in the Army, and my job is to kind of look at the chemical weapons intelligence and to plan the operation to defend my soldiers when we were over there. And the assessment that I saw from kind of the prevailing opinion in the industry, if you were, was that Iraq was a threat, definitely, but not a threat to the United States. And once I understood that and I felt that they were painting it in a different way, I was pretty unhappy with going to war. And as a soldier, you're not allowed to talk out. And now that I'm out, I can't talk about my experiences. But even back then, the one way that we always do have a way to influence policy is to vote. And I disagree with the policy, and so I'm going to vote.
And what was that like to go to a war that you, because of your personal intelligence, your job and what you knew, didn't really believe in?
Well, I wasn't very happy, obviously. And my wife was even less happy because she knew the circumstances. And I remember her talking to me, about how angry she would be if I didn't get to come home. And for me, when I was there, you don't worry about yourself, you worry about your family, And I was never in a situation where I was afraid for my own safety, but there were times when I was worried about how things were impacting my wife. My family told me about her staying up, for nights on end, watching CNN and just obsessing over whether or not I was okay, And I don't think people can understand the stress that puts on families.
But here you are, a Republican, and as you may know, many Democrats are equally angry and upset at John Kerry because he voted for authorization for the war.
I believe that Congress and the American people, I'm not going to say the president lied. That's not the case. I don't think they ever said anything that was untrue. But, there's such a thing as prevailing opinion, and I don't think that the prevailing opinion of the intelligence community was accurately presented, because what they presented was the opinion of obviously some people in the intelligence industry, but certainly not the majority.
But some would say John Kerry would have known that because he's on so many Senate committees and he would have known what was true. Where's the disconnect between John Kerry's vote and the Bush administration?
I think that the Bush administration has a very effective public relations team, and I think that they did a very good job. You've got a corporate administration, and I saw that as a good thing in 2000. I saw the CEO experience as a positive thing, but now I've got a situation in which you've got a whole team of people who are used to selling ideas, and I think they put that experience to use in a way that they thought was positive, but that, in my opinion, probably wasn't in the best interest of the country.
Okay, so here I have stumbled across a Republican evangelical Christian who's at the Kerry convention and possibly a Kerry supporter. You're going to decide by November. What does your family back home in Indiana think of that?
That's very interesting. My mother is definitely the Bush core. She is a hardcore pro-lifer, anti-gay rights, conservative evangelical. And while she's not going to vote for Kerry because she's very much a one-issue voter on the subject of abortion, she's not voting for Bush either. Last I talked to her, she said she was going to abstain from voting for the president. And by the way, my mother is a major in the Air Force Reserve and just volunteered for a combat tour in Iraq. And so she's going to go do what I just did recently. So people who are in the military and who are close to the military have been very unhappy with a president who promised to take care of the military and really just has been a very different president than he was a candidate. I've just been very disappointed.
You used a phrase before about war.
That's right. I said war makes strange bedfellows.
David Chasteen of the group Operation Truth. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
As is well known, not all veterans support John Kerry. Joining us on the line is Ted Sampley, a founder of the group Veterans Against John Kerry. And, Ted, we're now engaged in a war in Iraq, where young Americans continue to die, and there's some question about how well-organized the situation is there after major combat operations. Now, as a veteran, do you not feel that having someone who has been in combat as president makes a difference to the way the military is led when you're at war?
Yeah, I agree that would obviously have an impact, and it would probably someone that understands combat, like Eisenhower, Patton, or someone that knows it in and out. Sure. In the case of John Kerry, he had less than 4 months in combat. John Kerry would not be that person. I know his military record in and out. I've studied it. I've read what the Boston Globe and others have written, and he doesn't have that knowledge. And he has been more of an advocate against our involvement in Vietnam, going back there, instead of for the U.S. Now, as far as his vote on Iraq is still in question.
The men who turn up time and time and time again to support John Kerry, from Iowa to last night on the convention podium?
Small handful.
A small handful?
Very few compared to my website, what we get, our emails, and with their thousands and thousands. We had 10 million hits in the first 90 days. We were up. And I'm in community. I assure you, I represent the average veteran out there, their feelings on John Kerry, and Iraqi veterans. And one of the women that worked here, her son was from Iraq, from the Iraq War, and he's talking about not even signing back up if Kerry's elected.
All right, Ted, well, we'll see you come November. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks for having me aboard.
Ted Sampley is a founder of the group Veterans Against John Kerry.
Both presidential candidates are pressing the flesh and kissing babies in swing states. Next time on Here and Now, we'll look at what the latest polls are showing.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
At the Democratic convention this week, journalists outnumbered delegates by almost 4-1. And sometimes it seemed they only came to Boston to moan about how little news there was and have some free booze. The big three networks sent their big guns, but controversially kept them under wraps for most of the week. ABC, NBC, and CBS's decision not to air much of the convention in prime time sparked criticism. The host of Meet the Press, Tim Russert, had this to say to critics of his network.
Conventions used to be much CTV because decisions were made. Now it's just a coronation. It's a TV event, and that's all it is. And so you have to pick and choose as to what events you're going to cover. And the parties know that. The parties could make the conventions newsy again. If you eliminate the primaries, the conventions would be a place to cover. It's their decision, not ours, in many ways.
Tim Russert's own network, NBC, missed the boat on one of the most exciting speeches, Tuesday night's keynote address by Barack Obama, senatorial candidate from Illinois, choosing instead to air reruns and reality shows. Joining us on the line are two veteran media watchers. Tom Rosensteel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at Columbia University. Hello, Tom.
Hi, good to be here.
And Mark Jerkowitz, media critic for the Boston Globe. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Michael.
Let's just jump on this point. The three networks chose to run about 3 hours of prime time and came under a lot of criticism for it. Mark, do you think that's justified?
I do think it's justified. First of all, it's amazing sort of the hubris that's inherent in Russert's remarks there. What's easy to do? Scrap the entire system by which we elect candidates for president of the United States, or have the networks perhaps it gives one more hour of primetime coverage? I don't know. It's hard to figure. My thinking on this has evolved, actually. Originally, I sort of bought the, hey, there's no news, it's a coronation. And after watching the coverage this week, I realized, and I think there's no reason why the networks, the broadcast networks, can't figure out how to put 2 hours at least of primetime convention programming on. And, ABC came up with this, we don't need to because we've got this new high-tech digital system in which three people with certain kinds of cell phones can get a streaming video broadcast. That's nonsense. The broadcast networks are still the mass television medium in this country. They all missed Barack Obama night. They missed a lot. And frankly, what's interesting to me is, as somebody who watched television through this whole thing closely, their guys were eclipsed. I mean, you know, Brokaw and Tim Russert are the big political heavyweights for NBC. You know what, to me, who carried that corporate, you know, media outlet banner for that company the entire convention was none other than Chris Matthews. He was on the air all the time. Russert looked like he, you know, he popped in for 1 or 2 minutes at a time. So I think they missed out.
Tom, do you think, as Mark says, the networks, we're focusing on them. There's a lot of other media. But the networks do have a kind of iconic importance in terms of disseminating electronically, at least, the news.
More than that, they have an agenda-setting influence that they would rather be rid of, but they can't seem to shake. What they put on the air influences what people know about and think about and talk about. The worst-rated network program has higher ratings than the best-rated cable program. And so there's something of a self-fulfilling prophecy here. If they don't air the conventions, fewer people will watch them. The fundamental problem here is that they don't, and this is true of a lot of journalists, not just the networks, the conventions used to be events that were in private that the press explained and filtered for the American public, where decisions were made. And that ended, changed 30 years ago when they reformed the presidential process and made it more of a primary process. They've gone from being events that the press explains to the public to being public events that the press simply shows and has a more passive role. And they are events at which the parties demonstrate who we are, what do we stand for, what ideas do we stand for, and who are the candidates who are running. The press then sort of annotates that as a kind of bystander role. It's a different role, but to suggest that these are not news would suggest that news is only things where the unexpected happens, but something that's important is not news. And these things are unquestionably important.
Michael, let me give you an example of a story that was missed, by the broadcast networks. For the hour that they were on, you know, they talked a lot about, you know, the big speculation was, oh, there's a, you know, aggressiveness is being tampered down here. There are marching orders for everyone, you know, to sort of keep the anger at a minimum. You know, Al Sharpton's speech, which, of course, was not seen by the broadcast networks, was off message. Well, guess what? What if they had actually spent some time interviewing delegates to find out exactly what the delegates thought and what the mood of the convention was and whether or not there was a little bit of a Potemkin village going on here with what we did see in primetime and whether or not the delegates were much further to the left than the presentation that most people got to see between 10 and 11. Instead of speculating on that in pundit soundbites, that could have been a story that could have been reported had they had the resources and the time to do so.
Okay, but what about the rest of the reporting that you saw, read, or heard? How do you rate the coverage here, Tom? Do you think that the press met its necessary obligations outside of making profits for its proprietors in terms of informing people?
Well, let's take it sort of a medium at a time. I think that cable in general, the three cable news networks, use the conventions as backdrops for branding their regular programming. So I wouldn't rate the cable performance very highly. With limited resources, PBS probably came closest to covering the convention. They were the big winners in terms of ratings and probably in terms of credibility in the electronic media. NPR, of course, does a fine job. It's very podium-heavy, and it's radio, and radio is a decent medium for understanding convention speeches. The print press was all over the place. There's a lot of performance reviews, and you have to pick and choose.
Mark,
the problem here is picking your diet. You know, you can dine out on junk food here or eat well.
Mark, I mean, put yourself in the mindset of a reasonably interested American voter. How do you think they got their news, and how do you think journalists took that responsibility?
Well, I think the reasonably interested, you know, voters that I talked to yelled at me for the storyline about no news, because I wrote that one day. As somebody who's absorbed 3 days of the cable news punditry cycle, I got to tell you, you know, the toxins are pouring out of my body as we speak. You know, it's one endless tape loop of conversation. It's hard. It's very formulaic, the coverage. You know, these events are events at which everybody shows up, everybody sets up their media tent, everybody sets up their equipment, and everybody marches off, and it's very stylized. It's difficult to sort of break out of the box and try and put ourselves in the mindset of real news consumers, and I think we get a B there at best.
Mark Jerkowitz, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Tom Rosenstiel, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tom Rosenstiel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at Columbia University. Mark Jerkowitz is the media critic for the hometown paper, the Boston Globe.
Still to come, just in time for a presidential campaign, Jonathan Demme's remake of the 60s classic, The Manchurian Candidate. We'll have a review.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
And most of your thoughts this week were about our coverage of the Democratic National Convention. We received a lot of response to our piece on dissent, or lack of it, with Victor Novosky, publisher of The Nation magazine. We commented that there were few demonstrators in the penned area set aside for them at the Democratic National Convention, which prompted Keith McHenry, a peace activist from Tucson, Arizona, to call.
As a protester who's been protesting now for 35 years, when they started the free speech zones, it was obviously not the place to protest. So it's very, very rare that there's ever any protesters ever in any free speech zones that are ever created for any of these kinds of events.
During our interview with Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, we asked about his comment in the film Fahrenheit 9/11 that he and other legislators don't read the bills they vote on. Well, Conyers told us if congressmen read every bill they vote on, they'd never be able to do anything but read. And he added, "What do you think we have dozens of staff people for?" Well, Robin Carpenter of Hanover, New Hampshire writes, "After 40 years in Congress with all that staff, it's not surprising that Conyers has embraced Washington's I'm too important, non-work ethic. If Conyers and his colleagues had read, analyzed, and decided their own positions on legislation, we would never have to suffer the convoluted, unfair, utterly impenetrable tax code we have all accepted in despair. Same goes for welfare, Social Security, education, and scores of other federal programs."
Boston Globe London Bureau Chief Charlie Sennett said on our program that foreign leaders would be more willing to join in a multinational effort in Iraq if there was a different administration in office. This prompted Lee Ray of Peoria, Arizona, to ask, "Does Sennett really believe that everyone will hold hands and sing Kumbaya if Bush leaves? I doubt that popular opinion abroad will shift so suddenly as to allow troops to be sent to a deadly area. Keep in mind that I am not a Bush fan, and I see a great deal of incompetence in the Iraq campaign."
Beth Stevens of Charlotte, North Carolina, objected to my questioning of party chair Terry McAuliffe at the DNC. She writes, "Your first question to him was, to paraphrase, 'Did your heart sink?' referring to how John Kerry might fare in comparison with the electrifying speeches delivered by Clinton, Carter, and Gore. From that point on, your point seemed to be to force a problem from McAuliffe. Well, I am a proud and unwavering supporter of old-school journalism. That is, get the story, don't create it."
And finally, Lori Mendelson of Lansing, Michigan, wanted to know, "What was the name of the song we played at the end of our interview with Arnold Ludwig, author of King of the Mountain, The Nature of Political Leadership?" Well, it was Tom Petty's It's Good to Be King, off the CD Wildflowers.
It's good to be king and have your own world. It helps to make friends. It's good to meet girls, a sweet little queen who can't run away. It's good to be king, whatever it pays.
Is it good to be king, Michael?
Robin, I have no way of knowing.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
Well, the Democratic National Convention has wound itself up, and with timing which I guess is probably planned, Paramount Pictures is releasing the remake of 1962's politically charged classic, The Manchurian Candidate. In director John Frankenheimer's original, Chinese communists brainwash Sergeant Raymond Shaw, an American captured during the Korean War, and condition him to be a sleeper assassin in the U.S. Shaw's power-hungry mother, Eleanor, played brilliantly by Angela Lansbury, is among the many covert agents involved in the conspiracy.
I know you will never entirely comprehend this, Raymond, but you must believe I did not know it would be you. I served them. I fought for them. I'm on the point of winning for them the greatest foothold they will ever have in this country. And they paid me back by taking your soul away from you. I told them to build me an assassin. I wanted a killer from a world filled with killers, and they chose you. Because they thought it would bind me closer to them. But now we have come almost to the end. One last step. And then when I take power, they will be pulled down and ground into dirt for what they did to you.
Mothers have never been looked at in quite the same way. Now, director Jonathan Demme has updated The Manchurian Candidate with a star-studded cast, and Here and Now film historian and reviewer Eric Schaefer is in the studio to talk about the legacy of the original and Jonathan Demme's remake. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Michael.
Now, Eric, when the original Manchurian Candidate came out, film we now regard as a classic, it really wasn't very successful.
No, it wasn't particularly successful at all. It was really only after the Kennedy assassination and the fact that United Artists pulled the film from release that it began to build sort of a reputation. Frank Sinatra eventually bought the rights to the film and kept it under wraps until it was re-released in 1987. And by that time, we had gone through the Kennedy assassination. We had gone through Watergate. So I think people were much more attuned to the sort of paranoid political thriller elements in the film. And they were much more accepting of some of the modernist devices that were used in the film, the way in which it was shot.
Yeah. The film is adapted from a novel by the late Richard Condon. And we should just talk about him for a moment. He never thought he was writing dark political thrillers with a message about our democracy being under threat. He thought he was just writing satires about the way powerful men behave.
Well, I think that the original Manchurian Candidate, although some people have seen it as a satire, it really comes across as a pretty straight political thriller with all of those elements involving brainwashing, which, of course, was a tremendously hot topic in the late 1950s. You can really hear this in this scene from the original with Frank Sinatra, where he talks about his relationship with Raymond Shaw.
I tell you, there's something phony going on. There's something phony about me, about Raymond Shaw, about the whole Medal of Honor business. For instance, when the psychiatrist asked me how I felt about Raymond Shaw, how I personally felt about him, and how the whole patrol felt about him, did you hear what I said? Did you really hear what I said? I said, Raymond Shaw is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life. And even now I feel that way, this minute. And yet, somewhere in the back of my mind, something tells me it's not true. It's just not true.
In the new version, the Jonathan Demme version, the Frank Sinatra role, as it were, is played by Denzel Washington.
Mm-hmm.
The Angela Lansbury role, Raymond Shaw's mother, is played by Meryl Streep.
That's right, and they both do a marvelous job. Denzel Washington is particularly excellent, and he's very different than Sinatra was in the original. Sinatra was very sort of edgy and jittery, like a guy on a caffeine jag. Denzel Washington is a man who is really trying to hang on to his sanity, and he gives a marvelous performance.
Somebody got into our heads with big steel-toed boots, cable cutters and a chainsaw, and they went to town. Neurons got exposed, and circuits got rewired. Our brain cells got obliterated, Raymond. Please. You need to get help, Ben.
That's Liev Schreiber in that scene with Denzel Washington playing Raymond Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one part of the update. The paranoia of the early 60s was about world communism.
Mm-hmm.
What is the object of paranoia in the update?
Well, the object of paranoia in this film is this large multinational corporation called Manchurian Global, which is trying to worm its way into the political process to essentially buy the vice presidency. But you also got the element of Homeland Security and the way in which it's being used as a potentially politically divisive element in the election. That's really the major thrust of Eleanor Shaw's reason for presenting her son as a vice presidential candidate.
Make no mistake, the American people are terrified. They know something's coming. They can feel it. And we can either shovel them the same old sugar, or we can arm them. We can arm them with a young, vibrant vice president. We can give them heat, energy, give them a war hero with heart, forged by enemy fire in the desert, in the dark, when American lives hung in the balance.
Meryl Streep there. You would have to say that Jonathan Demme, having had a pretty good run in the 90s, really took on a lot by deciding to remake this classic. Has he succeeded?
Yeah, I think he has. I think he's contemporized the film and made it very, very relevant.
So here's a film that comes out the day after the Democratic Convention ends. Is it an overtly political film? Is it a film that's going to cause controversy by being seen as yet another bit of liberal propaganda in an election year? Or is it just good old-fashioned, scary, paranoid entertainment?
It is that. I don't know that it's overtly political. People might want to read overt politicism into this, but it basically is operating as a cautionary tale about the way in which the electorate cedes far too much power to special interests, to big media, whether it's through apathy or through fear. And I think that people who see this movie are going to think long and hard about their role as citizens, particularly in this upcoming election.
Eric Schaefer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Film historian and reviewer Eric Schaefer talking about Jonathan Demme's remake of the 1962 classic, The Manchurian Candidate. And just before we go, Robin, you've been down at Boston's Fleet Center all this week. Any images that stand out?
Oh, so many. Boston at its best. Silly hats, my favorite, a big wooden donkey. Thrilling democracy at work, a handful of Teamsters from New Jersey trying to spell out the name of their state rep, you know, with tiny little flashcards. Seeing Madeleine Albright standing all alone at 6 a.m. waiting for a hair salon to open. You know, I complimented her on an interview in Czech. Well, I thought it was Czech. We heard her give. She said, oh, my dear, that was Slovak. Our bilingual Here and Now producer, Karen, being asked to explain the phrase, shove it, to the foreign press. The protest pen, the microphone was used mostly for a sort of karaoke. And the speeches. You know, politics aside, we heard some pretty good speechifying at times.
Yes, we did.
So now, Michael, it's on to the Republicans in New York in August.
And I wonder if it will be as cool, calm, and collected as it was here in Boston this week.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
And I have Congressman Arthur Davis of Alabama between now and 5 if you're interested.
The donkey, yeah.
Okay, you lift up his ear, and oh, something appears to... Oh, your cigarettes come out of the back. Well, look at that.
We missing the seat? All right, we got it right.
The Rockettes don't work this hard.
Le shove it, qu'est-ce que ça signifie exactement en anglais?
Shove it, c'est pas très poli, ça veut dire...
And I want to introduce our next speaker, Tom Hayden.
Tom Hayden is a communist from the Vietnam War era. He was married to
Jimmy. I don't want anybody fighting with no hands on anybody, okay?
I didn't put my hands on anybody.
This song will close the Democratic Convention. Someday we'll be together.
Americans look at a convention and think, well, if he can run a convention, he might be able to run a government. I'm not sure that really necessarily follows, but it does probably follow that if you can't run a convention, you can't run a government.
Thank you. I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.